Welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. We are a vibrant international community for those who have questions or doubts about their faith. I'm your host, Tim Reimel, along with my co-host, Bill Prickett.
Our guest today is Rhonna Russell. She grew up as the youngest daughter of a United Pentecostal preacher. I can't wait to talk to her about that. But she could not wait to get out of her house. So she got out very young, was married at the age of 23, a marriage that lasted 22 years and produced 4 children. Rhonna is a blogger, a recent author, and she is an outspoken advocate for women. So Rhonna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
I want to begin with your church background. It says you were the youngest daughter of a United Pentecostal preacher. Now, I know that a United Pentecostal church is different than what we consider mainstream Pentecostal church.
Yes.
Can you talk to us about some of those differences? Because they're significant.
They are. The United Pentecostal Church is... Boy, where to start? It is, to my view, a cult. If you read the earmarks of what a cult is, they meet every single one. They cloister themselves. They shut themselves off from the rest of the world. Don't socialize with anyone who doesn't go to their church. Not even other types of Christians who have to belong to that United Pentecostal Church. Organization in order to be saved. That's the criteria. There are extremely strict rules that apply to all areas of life. Not only who you can socialize with, but where you can go. When I was growing up, no one had a television. You couldn't go to movies. You were not supposed to, or not even sports, any kind of sports games. You couldn't listen to music that wasn't Christian, or even were discouraged from reading any kind of books that weren't biblically based. That doesn't even begin to talk about the appearance based rules. Women in particular, you know, you had to wear dresses, no makeup, no jewelry, couldn't cut your hair. Your dresses had to be a certain length. The sleeves had to be a certain length. So it was really a clamped down, oppressive environment. Men had rules too, but not nearly to the same degree. And certainly what is now referred to as purity culture was a big deal as well. Lots of rules about relationships and what's appropriate and what's not. And the message that's pounded home on a daily basis is that the wages of sin is death, meaning if you step out of line, the rapture could happen at any moment and you're in hell and that's it. So there's a whole lot of fear around making sure that you stay in line and follow the rules and don't mess up. It's absolutely a fear-based religion.
Well, and I do think that's one of the strongest reasons that we who came out of the evangelical church, the idea of sin and hell are very strong control-based concepts. And so they produce fear, which in turn then serve to control us.
Right.
Now, Tim is also from a Pentecostal background, but it wasn't UP.
We were the Pentecostal Church of God.
Yeah, see, you were loose.
Well, what you described was pretty similar to how I grew up. I mean,
yeah,
I can't remember if I told the story in another episode or not, but the pastor or somebody in our church caught, and I use that in quotes, my mom wearing pants, which were, you know, slacks.
Right.
And so they told on her. And so, you know, women always wore dresses. They weren't allowed to wear, quote unquote, men's clothing. So that became an issue. But, you know, my father stood up for her. He had different beliefs. And as we were talking before we started recording, you know, my grandparents were UPC. And so there was always these theological debates between them and my father. I was a kid. I didn't understand any of that stuff, but they both of them seemed to be very right.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of a woman being ostracized and punished for wearing a pair of slacks is so insane. And if you just take a big step back and look at that language and listen to that language and what that means to a person who's, you're in trouble for an item of clothing. It's crazy. And that people accept it and go along with it is also crazy to me.
See, I came out of a Southern Baptist background and we were very conservative, but there were not that many of those kind of rule-based things. There were some. I was a youth minister and I got called in to the pastor's office on a couple of occasions. One, because I let at a summer youth camp, I let the kids swim in the same lake together.
Ooh. And in swimming suits?
Yeah, they were wearing swimsuits, but they were swimming in the same pool. And so that was not allowed in our church.
No.
And I got called in one time because I had worn shorts. I had come from a youth event and came to my office to get some work done. And I was still in shorts. And that was not acceptable. But we didn't have a lot of these other rules. Now, when I was married, my ex-wife came out of a strict fundamental Baptist background, and they had some of these same rules. She tells the story of when she was saved and walked down the aisle in her church. One of the women that came up and spoke to her afterwards says, "Well, praise God, now you can't wear pants anymore." And it was like, so that's the sign of a good Christian. You don't wear pants anymore.
Oh, wow.
Now, you said that your father was a fairly well-known United Pentecostal pastor.
He was. Well, he didn't pastor a church for most of my life. He, when I was born, he had pastored as a younger minister. And then when I was born in St. Louis, that's where the headquarters is of the United Pentecostal Church. That's their big, where their office complex is, their administration. And he worked there for probably the first 10 years of my life, running the foreign missions department. And then he transitioned to running Bible colleges. He ran a Bible college in Jackson, Mississippi, and then in Portland, Oregon, which is where it all kind of fell apart for him. He was too liberal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, his deal when he started, he got into the teaching, you know, all these college age people, and they had their whole curriculum. He encouraged people to think for themselves a little bit, and it didn't go over well, because that's really the antithesis of that's the opposite of the purpose of Bible college.
Well,
the purpose of the Bible college is to train these young people to be ministers and to teach them exactly what to think. And he took a slightly different approach, and it didn't, he basically got kicked out by the time he was in, at the college in Portland, Oregon. His career was on the rocks.
And I find that interesting that, there's always a spectrum within any, even within closed organizations. You defined the United Pentecostals as a cult, but even within these closed systems, there's this spectrum. You're too liberal. You don't do it right. You don't believe this the same way we do. And that I've seen that for years in monitoring and watching Christian groups and organizations, but we definitely...
You have to toe the party line.
Yeah, the worst thing for a closed group is letting people think for themselves.
Exactly. Because, and you know what? This sounds really strange, but the ministers and the, you know, the board of the church who really came after him, in a sense, they were right. He was a threat, because all of those people who attended his Bible college classes ended up leaving the UPC.
Wow.
And a lot of them credit him for that, for allowing them to think a little more freely. So they weren't wrong in that he was threatening their system.
Right. Well, and isn't that kind of the idea behind get them while they're young theology, where you want to make sure you have these kids, but you know, before they're 18, because if you don't, then there's a possibility, a likelihood that they'll leave. And that's, you know, that's why there's so much anti-education. And it was interesting. My father was also inquisitive. And he, one of the things he wanted to do that he never did was become a history teacher. And I've often thought back to that, those statements that he's made about what would have been different? What would life have been like in our family had that been different? He, you know, he did stress education for us. I was forced to get my associate's degree against my will because I wanted to go to Bible school. And I'm very appreciative now. I went on and, you know, got a graduate degree, as did my sister.
He did you a huge favor.
Yes. So education became very important in our family, and it's important, you know, with my own kids. But you're still thinking within the confines of your faith and your belief. So, he, you know, he's very much an evangelical now. As I mentioned, he has Alzheimer's. So his thinking is limited, but he still holds to those beliefs that he's always had. So it is dangerous from an outside perspective, or from self-preservation is definitely dangerous for any kind of cultish behavior.
Absolutely.
Now, Rana, within your home, your father is a well-known United Pentecostal preacher, mm-hmm. well-known leader,
yes.
But things were not always good at home with your father and you.
No, he had a violent temper. Just a real boy. What's the right word? It was emotional abuse, mm-hmm. a whole lot more so than it was physical abuse. My role in life, as well as my sister's roles and my mother's, was to make him look good. So any little stepping out of line, you know, his liberalism, quote unquote, did not extend to our home. We had to look the part, act the part, reflect well on him. That's what we were there for. And so any perceived rebellion or tone of voice he didn't like, or any little thing was met with his raging temper. And because he was intelligent, he knew how to wound with words really, really well. And he was scary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that, and you know, once in a while you would meet up with the back of his hand, but,
right.
But mostly he just would dismantle you with his words.
And I grew up in that kind of household.
So did I.
With mm-hmm. the abuse and the brutality of, you know, it was also physical, but it was more verbal than anything. It was psychological. It was so dismissive and degrading. And don't you think that's very difficult to overcome? I mean, the physical, I'm not saying that physical abuse is a good thing, or I'm not trying to be comparative here, but right. We can get over physical wounds. But to this day, I can hear those things in my head.
Yes. Yes. That's a very good point. I think sexual abuse and physical abuse is easier to point to and say, this thing was done to me. And this is how it made me feel. And this is how I, you know, the steps I have to take to recover and heal. Emotional abuse, psychological abuse, and verbal abuse is more difficult to pinpoint. Oh, you know, it's because it sounds like you're saying, oh, well, they were mean to me and I'm scarred. Well,
yeah.
That kind of abuse goes so much deeper than just mean words or unkind language. It really does some damaging things to a child's head, you know, and the way that you see yourself, the way you see your own value or your lack of value. That's probably at the bottom of it, is it just takes your perception of your own value out of the equation. You don't have any because you're treated like, I don't know if I can curse on this show.
Yes, you may.
You're treated like shit, and so you feel like shit. And that follows you until you find a way to acknowledge it and cope with it and recover.
And
I proceeded throughout my life with the mentality that I am going to pretend like this never happened. I'm going to get on with it. I married, you know, the first guy that came along. I wanted to surround myself with a family of my own so I could do it differently. And I did those things. But because I hadn't taken the time to really acknowledge my own trauma, at the end of the day, it came back around. And I had to deal with it eventually.
Yeah, because it doesn't just affect how we see ourselves. It affects how we relate to other people and interact with other people. Because I always found myself, and to this day, tone of voice will cause me to cringe. Mm-hmm. There's just, if my husband uses a certain tone of voice, I find myself stiffening up and it will get a reaction from me very quickly. Even though there's not a harsh bone in his body, I'm just very sensitive to tone of voice, whether it's him or anyone. And so it affects how we interact with other people.
It absolutely does. I was completely unequipped to be in the world and have a relationship and friendships with normal people. I didn't know how. And that followed me. That really affected the upbringing of my children because I was unable to socialize successfully. So we were, you know, we grew up in a little bubble of my creation because, you know, they say it takes a village to raise a child. And that's really true. But if you don't know how to be a successful member of the village, your wider community, your kids pay, and mine did. You know, I think it was hard on them to have such an introverted parent who couldn't get along socially.
Yeah, I can relate to all of that.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry, because this is something Tim and I have talked about in private, we've heard from other guests. I know it affected me. My father both pushed me to be out and personable and friendly, but at the same time, I was, as you talked about, a shy, kind of withdrawn person. So I've lived most of my life in this dichotomy of wanting to just go sit in the corner to read a book, but also then feeling pushed out into being personable, being active, being involved.
Right.
Well, you know, when you're an author, and all three of us are authors, there's a lot of marketing. You really have to go out and push yourself and market yourself and talk about yourself.
And I hate that.
It's extremely uncomfortable, right?
It's
easier. And, you know, and I also have clinical depression. So it's, so I just go through these periods of time where I just disappear. I just can't do it anymore, you know? And if you look back through your life and you think about, well, what happened? What caused all this? You're right. There is.
You were devalued.
Yes.
Yes.
You were
yes.
devalued. You were told you weren't anything. You were stupid. You mm-hmm. couldn't make it. Right. So growing up, that's what I heard. That's what I believed. And it's been a lifetime of trying to unravel all of those things.
That's a great word. Unraveling.
Oh, yeah.
That's what it is, because there isn't a point you get to and say, oh, I'm
right.
fine now. I have it all figured out.
I'm unraveled now.
I'm unraveled. No, it's just a continual process. It's a really big blanket.
It is. I'm 66 years old now, and I still, these things come up and they still pop back and I'm back to this 14, 15 year old being put down.
Well, and it's like we were talking about earlier, Ron, off before we started recording, is that, you know, I keep my house like a model home because it's I'm so focused on everything has to be in its place, and I've always been that way, and I know the triggers, right? So when I start doing this the way that I'm doing it now, is that I have to go back and talk to my therapist. I'm like, all right, you know, I'm clearly something's out of whack here, because that's my go-to thing, is to put everything back in its place and make things appear like it's everything's okay,
like it's perfect. Right.
Yes.
It's something we can control. And I'm the same way. Yeah. These are areas that I can control. I could never control my father's temper or how he was going to respond, but I could keep all of my books alphabetized, and I could keep my room cleaned up. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I think we do that. And I don't know with your father, I know that, do you think that some of his temper related to his own secrets that he was hiding from you guys?
It must have. He had a huge ego. He was a narcissist, was very focused on being successful. image was extremely important. But then there were underlying issues that he wasn't addressing, right? When I was in high school, he met a man who he fell in love with. Mm-hmm. And it was a sexual awakening for him. And I can't tell his story, but that's what happened. He began to live a double life and he began to lie to everyone. And there was a lot of financial impropriety that went along with that. So he left our family in a difficult situation and was very, very unkind to my mother. He didn't give her the honesty that a spouse deserves when big changes are coming. So that was really unfortunate. And then they finally did divorce. He made her do it. She left him. She divorced him and he got on with his life with his partner and moved away. And this was back in the late 80s, early 90s. And he contracted HIV and didn't tell anyone until he had AIDS. And then he was dead within 6 months.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, thank you. It was also traumatic on so many levels that when he finally died, it was almost a relief. It was like, okay, well, that's over. Let's just move on. But there's, again, it's another layer of trauma on top of the upbringing. This person, that you can't not love your parent, but there was so much pain involved.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to laugh.
No, it's okay.
I've heard that so many times over the years. You have to love him. He's your dad. So I hear you.
Well, there's a deep level of need, yeah. And I'm not sure that that's love. Right. But as a kid, if you never got what you needed from them, some part of you still needs it. And you have to figure out, since you can't get it from them, mm-hmm. you got to figure out how to fill that hole. And there are lots of ways to do that, healthy ways and unhealthy ways. And I did it in unhealthy ways a lot until I figured out kind of, you know, how to be okay to the degree that I am, at least.
In your church, as in most fundamental churches, women are not raised with a high sense of worth. The church is very, very male focused.
Yes.
It puts women in a second class position.
Correct.
And so I'm always fascinated by women who are able to come through that with a strength, with a confidence, as I hear and listen to you. I applaud that kind of healing and courage.
Thank you. I got into a conversation one time with around resilience, and that's just something that I seem to, that's innate to me. At the same time, too much of it prevents you from acknowledging what you need, because you're so busy surviving and you're so busy being resilient that you're not addressing the needs that need to be met, the emotional traumas, and that you're not. I was so busy pretending like it never happened that I never talked to anybody. I didn't want to tell my story. And then, so the years went by, 4 kids, you know, we're going along. I married a creative type of guy who came from an atheist family. And I thought, well, this is the exact opposite of what I came from. And this is great. And then at about the 20 year mark, you know, something had always been off between he and I. We never really had much of a physical connection, and that was something that was really missing for me. And I had started to question his sexuality, only to discover that he's also gay. And I had to I can't really say that he came out. I kind of pushed it. Like, this is something that you've got to acknowledge. Like, it was an ugly breakup, and it was hard on the kids. And painful all around.
I imagine.
Yeah. So then I'm in this situation, you know, having my father had gone through this, I had ignored my own emotional development for years, and then it happens to me. And I said, how the hell did this happen to me? And I had to figure out why. How did I find myself in the exact same position that my mother found herself in? It was a wild ride. And that's when I started to write. I left him single mom for a while, you know, working two jobs. And I started, that's when I started to write.
So much to unpack here.
Yeah.
Let's,
yeah, it's a lot.
I'm going to kind of go back and talk about growing up in the church. Mm-hmm. When did you begin to question? And I kind of gather from this conversation, I could be way off here, but there's something in you that is a questioner. There's something in you that is a bit rebellious where you thought, this isn't right. This isn't
absolutely
right for me. I mean, you have something about you that I know you do some things with women's rights and, so I'm really curious to hear what you were thinking, what you were feeling, you know, growing up in that church, in that environment.
Yeah, that's a big question. And there are several different facets to it. Some of it was the emotional disconnection with, the speaking in tongues and the shouting and the running around and the weeping and the wailing that happened in church on a regular basis. I did not connect with that. And so by the time I was an adolescent, I was looking around at all of this emotionalism happening around me and not feeling it. And I was kind of an observer. So I spent my teenage years watching what was happening and feeling left out because I wasn't connecting and feeling afraid because I was worried that there was something deeply wrong with me. But at the same time, just hating it deeply. And so I just started to tune out and push everybody away. And I became more and more and more introverted. And I did have my nose in a book all the time. And I was kind of biding my time. And at the same time, I, for whatever reason, seemed to have a pretty high-powered libido. And so I started acting out sexually along the way and got myself into plenty of risky situations that were not healthy in any way. So there was a kind of a lot going on internally with these random bouts of risk-taking that were... should have scared me.
Was this before your first marriage or after?
Both. Actually, before my first marriage. And then how I kind of reclaimed my life, my body, myself, when I my marriage was over towards the end of it, I said, well, you know, I haven't had a real sexual partner in 22 years, and I'm going to have one now. I essentially told my husband, no, I'm going to sleep with somebody. It doesn't have to be you. He had his own situation to figure out, and that's not my story to tell. I will say that he is happily remarried to a man, and it's all good. He's got a nice life, and he seems really, really happy, and I'm happy for him. But I did decide to meet that need. I needed a sexual partner. I needed to reclaim my body and feel like myself again. And that's the first step I took to fixing it.
Did you think maybe God was something else?
What do you mean?
You're observing what's happening in church. Did you think that that wasn't God, or did you think people were overreacting, or did you think God was something else, or did you think God didn't exist?
It was a gradual process of getting to the place where I felt like God didn't exist. But at the beginning of the doubting process, it was just scary because everyone around me was participating in something that I couldn't connect with. And that was frightening. And then over time, it just became more and more ridiculous to me, so that by the time I was an older teenager, I really just did not believe.
In your younger years, who was God to you then?
The set of rules.
Hmm. Did you ever feel emotionally connected to God?
No.
Never, even as a child in that environment?
No. I can't say that I did.
Okay, so you're in the environment and you're watching all of these things happening around you. Your father is abusive. Did you have this feeling of injustice inside you?
Yes. Yes. Screaming. Yes. Yes. I was furious. I was angry at the injustice from as far back as I can remember.
And you saw the disconnect between maybe what your father is preaching and what you're living?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's... Yeah. Is that weird?
No, no, I'm just, I totally, I was a very angry child. Yeah, I didn't have that because we didn't grow up in church. Mm. And I've always, you know, when I was a pastor and my kids were young, I always wanted I struggled to, you know, to be the same person to them that I was in church and vice versa, mm-hmm. because I didn't mm-hmm. want that dichotomy that I grew up with, the person that people saw, because my parents ran a restaurant and my dad was just, you know, out there, very friendly, very open, and everybody loved him, thought he was just so wonderful. And I thought he was a bastard. And it was just, yeah, you know, that kind of yeah. disconnect.
Interesting. I don't know if I was felt like, I guess I kind of felt the same way in a way, not that my dad was super friendly necessarily. He was a figure of authority everywhere he went and people listened to him, but he didn't show the mean streak out in public very often. I saw it sometimes and recognized that I was not the only person who was afraid of him.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to hear more about your involvement with women's issues and where this led you.
Okay.
Recovering from Religion is funded by those who believe in what we do. We invite you to support us with a monthly or one-time donation. Go to our website, recoveringfromreligion.org, and click on the donate button for instructions. On the website, you'll also find an extensive database of resources, including links, articles, and videos. We offer 24-hour phone and chat line support, along with the links to meetup groups in 20 communities around the U.S., With our secular therapy project, we can connect you with a professional who offers evidence-based, non-religious treatment. Our partner therapists understand the complexities of rethinking or leaving your faith. Finally, Recovering from Religion is an entirely volunteer-run organization. If you're interested in being a volunteer with us, please visit recoveringfromreligion.org and look for the volunteer tab.
So, Rhonda, tell us about your passion for women's rights. I mean, I can only assume that this comes out of your upbringing and the way that you were treated.
Yes.
What do you see as the issue with women's rights that's not being addressed, or maybe not being addressed appropriately?
That's a huge topic of conversation. And I feel like it goes all the way back to pre-recorded history, where women were lumped together with children and livestock as property. We were owned by men. If you go back to the beginning of recorded history, that's the setup. Mm-hmm. Men own the land, men own the cows, men own their wives,
right.
And men own their children. And looking around, I can see that, you know, as cultures and societies grew and evolved and religion became, you know, up until a fairly recent history, there was no separation of church and state. So religion was used to reinforce that dynamic. And now here we are, we have civil rights to some degree. We have women's rights to some degree. But that underlying culture of women, as you said this earlier, as women coming in second, mm-hmm. it's something that we're still recovering from. So it's not just about abortion. It's not just about equal pay. It's about the role of women in society and how we're, the Me Too movement, in my mind, is a huge step forward mm-hmm. For women to actually speak their truth and tell their stories out loud and for someone to hear it and believe it. That has everything to do with the internet and women being able to talk to each other and hear each other. When I heard some of the Me Too stories, I started having flashbacks to memories of various times throughout my life where men have been inappropriate. And those memories are clear as day. I never even knew that they qualified as some level of either molestation or harassment or just being generally inappropriate. I didn't even understand that it's part of a wider societal structure that is essentially rape culture, where where men can do what they want to women and women have no recourse. And so we see that changing, but there's still kind of a long way to go. We're not there yet. And so I just want to be part of that conversation and pointing out how religion is a part of that. These churches that tell women that, you know, God's going to speak to your husband, so you listen to him.
Right. Yeah.
And that sounds like a thing of the past, but it isn't.
No.
It's still very, very much true in these cultures. Yeah.
And even if it's not that direct, there are very subtle messages like that, that mm-hmm. I can remember back as far, you know, from when I was growing up in church, that you know, the husband is the head, the husband is the covering, mm-hmm. All of the wife should submit. The wife, right. If the wife has any questions, she goes to her husband. So all of that right. just promotes this culture. And some of it is so subtle. My husband and I were watching television the other night, and there was an older TV show, and there was a wedding ceremony. And I stopped it and started showing him all the ways that in an old wedding ceremony, it perpetuates some of the ideas you were talking about. The father gives away the bride because right. the father owns the bride. And now the husband is going to own the bride and
right. transference of property.
Yeah. And then in the end, so often the minister would say, I now pronounce you man and wife, not husband and wife. Right. So often, because he's the man and she's uh-huh. the wife. And so there's subtle things that just, I think as women, I'm just so fascinated with the way you and others have come out of that, because it is bombarded on you for so long in so many different ways.
Right. Right. So yeah, I came out ready to fight because I recognize it now. I see it so clearly now. And I did discover as an adult that there are normal Christians, plenty of people who have religious beliefs and spiritual beliefs, and it doesn't control every aspect of their being. And I did not know that until I was an adult. One thing that I'm remarried now, and my husband is a Christian. He goes to an Episcopalian church, which is very open and accepting and a loving place. And this is all news to him, that these cultures exist, that they oppress women, that they cover up abuse, they silence children, and they're still around, and they have allies in the White House. And not to get too political here, but I feel like it's really important for the general population who maybe aren't thinking too much about this to understand the zealotry that's behind those beliefs. It's really difficult to get people who don't know about it to take it seriously. I've had people read my book and say, well, gee, it sounds like you made it up. But I didn't. And these people are still, they're still here, and they have a lot of power, and now they have a lot of money in politics, and they have an agenda. And I'm not suffering under the delusion that I can save the world or anything, but if I can be a voice, if I can help anybody see a way out, if I can help any other woman find their voice and forgive themselves for maybe being sexual. I've had emails from people who are like, oh, I feel so bad. I have so much guilt. I have so much shame because I had sex outside my marriage, or I went online and I did this or that. And I say, you did what you needed to do for reasons that you can identify. You can take the guilt and the shame out of it. So much of this goes back to sexual control of women. If we can take the guilt and shame out of it, then we can look at it as a healing method. I had, just as an example, when I was leaving my first marriage, I went online. I was looking for sex. I wasn't looking for companionship or friendship or a conversation. I was looking for something specific. And I found it. I did what I needed to do. I had the affair. It was great. I felt like I had gotten put back in my body, and I'll never apologize for it. And I think that women are generally supposed to apologize for needing sex for sex sake. And I reject that notion.
You know, as a father of two daughters, I think about that all the time I think, okay, you know, I've got a 20-year-old and an 18-year-old, mm-hmm. Both of them lost their virginity or gave it away mm-hmm. on the same year.
Yeah. You don't lose it.
Right.
It can be taken.
Yes. It wasn't taken. They gave
yeah.
it away.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I heard from some, you know, a couple of people like, oh, what do you think about that as a dad? And I thought, I'm fine with it. I mean, they're yeah. adults.
Yeah.
They waited. They were sexually responsible. Both of them got birth control on their own. Mm-hmm. Sex is amazing and everybody should do it.
Yes. You know,
so I don't have a problem with that. And I feel like it is their body. It is. Those are their choices. And I'm not going to shame them. I'm not going to, you know, I've always loved the fact that my daughters have talked to me about sexuality comfortably. Because I didn't grow up that way. So I will be honest, I had to go to my therapist quite a bit and discuss what was happening.
But that's okay.
Yeah, the conversations he and I had, I'm like, can you believe they said this?
My daughters are very much the same. And there were moments when I said, oh, I regret telling them that they could tell me everything. Because now they are.
I never told them they could tell me everything. They just won't stop.
You're the cool dad.
You're
the cool dad.
You are. They trust you, is what that they, is.
My daughters, on July 4th, we gave them some sparklers, and they had a contest with those sparklers to see who could draw the most penises on the ground before the sparkler went out. So that's what I'm around, right? And I'm like, yeah. There's children around here. But they do their own thing. And you know, part of me, like I said, I enjoy the fact that they are free and they're open and I don't have to control them. And, you know, it's their lives, their bodies. And you know, I was just saying the other day, as I was talking to my daughter and she's 20 and I was listening to her and I was really biting my tongue not to do the fatherly thing and give advice with everything that she said. So I was just letting it happen. But I thought, you know, as a young lady, she's got to grow up. She's got to make those choices on her own. And I want her to know that I'm supportive, not that I'm going to stand here and tell her what she's doing is wrong.
Right. That's the best gift you can ever give her. That's beautiful.
You know, back to what you're talking about with how women are viewed in the church and even culturally is my sister, who I'm hoping never listens to this show. my sister, educated, smart, all those things. But when we talk about how women are treated, she just shrugs her shoulders and said, well, that's just the way it is. Men just treat women like that. And it's just part of life. And I have said to her at one point, why can't we change it? Why can't it be different? And she, again, shrugs her shoulders and that's just how it is. She's a tough old broad. But I know that there was a lot of influence with her growing up with religion. And even though she's not a Christian, she still holds very tightly to her conservative values and beliefs. And she absolutely refuses to do any research or look at, you know, anything that I send her, any websites, any TED Talks, any books that I've suggested. She ignores all of those things. And it drives me absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
You know, we can't have a conversation, but I remember when she was younger, she was very much a feminist or at least a feminist in that time. And I just keep wondering what happened? Where did that go? Yeah,
it's a good question.
You know, because I do think a lot of it is the culture. A lot of it is the religion. And when you are part of the conservative movement, you have very strong ideas about male and female roles and what you're supposed to do. And even for those of us that walked away from religion or Christianity or whatever, that stays with us.
You
know, just because you change your existential beliefs doesn't mean that you've changed your conservative mindset and what contributed to you becoming the way that you are.
Right. It's deeply ingrained.
How do you talk to people who are still, or at least in this place of rethinking what they believe and still holding on to those archaic beliefs? Because as you said, that is true. It comes from our history from way back a long time ago. How do you broach the subject with women and what do you say to them?
I usually, if I'm talking to someone about this kind of stuff, especially around sexuality and leaving religion, it's usually one-on-one. I post things online, you know, sometimes that generates conversation, but more often than not, it's the emails or the private messages online that I get. With women sharing their own pain. And my first and foremost, my job is is to listen and not judge. And if I can be helpful in helping them accept their journey and think about their journey, I kind of hate that term, but you know, everyone has a process of recovery and healing and sorting themselves out. If they can do that without beating themselves up, and if I can help them, maybe you know, to point out, this is, you're beating yourself up here. You don't have to. You can just accept that this is what you needed to do at the time, and this is what you got out of it. Then I feel like I can be a positive and empathetic sounding board for people. And I have found myself in situations where I've had to say, you know, I'm not a therapist, but I think that we all need one. It's a really important piece of this process is to talk to a qualified professional about how you feel and what you've been through and how to deal with your own trauma. So I tread carefully in those situations. I don't want to ever present myself as some sort of an expert and be able to tell someone this is what you need to do, except for on the occasion where I've told people that, well, you know, you really just need to, you need to tell them to fuck off. I'm not afraid to say that, but
yeah. That's sometimes very, very good advice.
Sometimes it really is. But you know, just I wrote a book. I told my story. That doesn't make me, that doesn't make me someone who can tell anybody else what to do or how to proceed. I have a lot of empathy and I'm willing to listen to anybody who just needs to talk without judgment.
On your website, you have, and I appreciate it, you have a page dedicated to what recovering from religion is and what we're doing. And it's very appreciated that you do that. What would you say to somebody who right now is maybe asking some of these questions that you asked a long time ago about their faith, or is this the truth? Mm-hmm. If they're trying to ask some of these questions, what would you say to someone?
Read everything. You know, there's such a long list of wonderful books and resources. And you know, reading is not everybody's thing, but it's mine. And that's where I got most of my encouragement. You know, the first book that I read that really blew my mind was The Power of Myth by Joseph Campbell and Bill Moyer.
Joseph Campbell, God.
Yeah.
We could have another entire episode on Joseph Campbell.
Right. And just reading the words that the story of the virgin birth is not exclusive to Christianity. And there are so many different mythologies and stories all over the world from cultures and religions that are completely disconnected. And there are similar themes. I had no idea. And that's kind of where it started for me. And then, you know, there's Trusting Doubt by Valerie Tarrico and Leaving the Fold by Marlene Winnow and your website, which offers real-time help and resources.
It really does. And so if people are listening and they're having questions, having doubt, the recoveringfromreligion.org website has a lot of resources. We have counselors who can chat with you. We have secular therapy program. There's a lot of resources there. And so the fact that you had it on your website, I wanted to bring that up.
Yeah. It's such an important resource. And I have a whole resources page. So that's, you're there and there's a book list. There's one link, and off the top of my head, I can't tell you what it's called, but it's a link to a website that has a very concise list of how do you know if you're in a cult? And it has the earmarkers of a cult. And it's very simple to read. It's bullet points. These are the things that cults do. And there's a secondary list that says how to know if you are a leader in a cult, which I think is equally important because I know some leaders of cults and they don't think that they are. But that's what's going on.
And people don't know that they're in cults. We've had a couple of people on our the podcast who are cult experts. And I ask that question to every one of them. Do people know? And every time the answer is no, they don't know they're in a cult when they're in a cult.
Yeah. They're true believers and they don't see what they're doing. So that's a great resource. is to just read the list and say, does my group fit this?
Let's talk about your book.
Okay.
Can you tell us what's in it, why you wrote it?
Yeah. It's called The Uncomfortable Confessions of a Preacher's Kid. And it looks like it's going to be a lighthearted read, and it's not, but it is, it's interesting, it's entertaining, and it is a quick read. I talk about growing up, my father's daughter in that environment and really lay out what it was like to be a child in that atmosphere. And then I talk about my own process through the, you know, hiding in a marriage and how I got out of that and how I put myself back together. I started it as a blog in about 2015. And I've said this before, every time these stories started bubbling out of me and I created a blog, I put it online. And every time I published a blog post that was a story about my younger years, I would have an anxiety attack. And I would just sit on the couch and shake. I don't know if maybe I thought lightning was going to strike. but I also didn't think anyone would really ever read it. Mm-hmm. And then when people started reading it and reaching out and relating, and I thought, well, shit, somebody's going to tell my mother. So I better tell her first.
I feel that way about every podcast. Right.
Every time we do one of these. Yes.
Oh, my goodness. And so that was actually kind of difficult. She read along a little bit. And sometimes I would say, hey, I'm going to publish something that you might not want to read. It's going to be, you know, might be painful. Not about her, but about my own situations. It just grew from there. And I got some encouragement to put it into a book. And I always had wanted to do that. And it took me 2 or 3 years to put it all together. And I didn't know how to write a book. I had to learn how to do that. But I got some help and I learned how. And it's just been the best thing to have this tangible, this is my life, this is what happened to me, and this is what I did with it. It feels good. I'm confident that it's an enjoyable read. It's got a lot of sex in it, so it's not for everyone. For some reason, some people don't like to read about sex. I don't get that because I do, but it was fun to write.
I have trouble writing about it. Tim and I have joked, I have a new novel coming out in the fall. And one of the most difficult scenes in there for me to write was this sex scene that was very crucial to the story. But writing about it, I'm very provincial. I'm old South. My mom didn't allow cussing in the house. So things like that are a struggle for me. I don't mind reading about it or talking about it. But writing it down for me has been a challenge.
Well, I was telling true stories, so that's probably
different.
Made it easier.
Yeah.
It is different. But I wonder if when you're writing a fictionalized sex scene, if you can put yourself in it and write it as if it what happened to you.
Yeah, I just didn't.
Pretend like you're writing a memoir.
I just don't. I've read some of those really graphic sex scenes that I just think, okay, I don't want to write that. I don't want to write that. So
then don't.
I wanted to find a way for it to happen organically without the graphic, you know, of all the adjectives and adverbs involved.
I have to admit, I had a blast writing it. It was fun.
I think it's writing about these things. Writing is cathartic. It's healing. Uh-huh. No matter what it is you write.
Yes, that is true.
Ron, are you doing speaking now, or
I'm doing this. I am. I've done a couple of podcasts prior, and I'm going to do another one next week, and then I am a full time university student, so classes start.
Oh, nice!
And then I have to not think about the book because I, at 52 years old, going to school full time is no joke. It takes really all of my mental faculties to do that. So I'm enjoying it. I'm loving it. I'm one semester in, and it's a wonderful opportunity. But I will. This is sort of my last push to market the book to the end of summer, and then I'm back to school.
Right. Good for you. So they can reach you on your website.
Yes.
RonnaRussell.com.
Yes, and the book's on Amazon.
And we will have links to both of those in the show notes. So look for them. And
thank you.
check it out. There's a lot of interesting information there, and you've gotten some incredible reviews. I have not read the book, but I went in and did a lot of research, and I read just the reviews were enough to make me want to read the book.
Well, thank you. I do have some great reviews. I'm just going to say this. It's a good book. It's fun to read.
I think that's okay. I think it's okay to say this is a good book. I understand that.
Yeah, I stand by it. I'm happy with it.
Good.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, thank you for being with us today. We have enjoyed talking with you and getting your perspective on these things. It's been a great time talking with you.
Great time for me too. Thank you so much for having me on. It's been really fun.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And good luck with your book. I know what that's like. So good luck. I hope it reaches a lot of people.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Recovering from Religion podcast. If you have questions for either of us or suggestions for future topics, you can email us at podcast@recoveringfromreligion.org. If you think you'd like to be one of our guests, we have a form on the podcast page of the Recovering from Religion website. We'd love to hear from you.